From Birmingham, Alabama, you're listening to the Flat Picking Pilgrim's Progress. I'm your host, Gary Furr, and I'm so glad to have you with me today. Whether you're sitting in your favorite chair or riding along in the car, I'm glad we're going to get to spend this time together. It's good to be back with you here on the Flat Picking Pilgrim's Progress. I've had to take a little time away for some family responsibilities, but it's good to be back with you. I want to give a word of appreciation to a couple of folks who have contributed to help make this broadcast possible. By clicking on that link and giving a little bit, you help keep this free for everybody. Thank you very much. Today I want to talk about driver's ed. Now, back in October, I went to my high school reunion, and it brought back a flood of memories. I hadn't been there in 50 years. But when I started wanting to be an adult, I got my permit and then my license. And someday, eventually, you get your turn at the wheel. I couldn't wait to drive, as most kids my age then, 16, couldn't wait to drive. And since my father was on the road with his job all the time, the task of mentoring me fell to my poor mother. I have heard that since that first time around, she may be mellowed a little bit. Now, our practice runs in the car went something like this. I would take off. My mother's white-knuckled right hand clenched the passenger handle, ready for emergency bailout to let me go over the cliff. Her left hand braced against the glove compartment. That was back before we had airbags. And I would say, Mother, I know what I'm doing. No, you don't. Be careful. Watch it. Watch it. Watch it. You're getting too close. Too close to the ditch. You're too close. Watch it. Mother, I was not. Line it up with the shoulder. No, too close. And she would call my name, and it would become sort of operatic in the middle. Gary! Well, you get the idea. And there were constant lectures and endless anger and resentment. The whole dynamic of adolescence concentrated into the front seat of a car. Hard-headed teenager, determined that he already knows everything. A fearful parent who's aware that they are paying for any wreckage that happens. And just as certain that you don't and that you're headed for disaster. Now, modern society tries to mitigate this by requiring driver's education. Driver's education is a class in which one heavily insured and underpaid adult endures most of this agony for the rest of us. I took driver's ed in Dayton, Ohio at Northmont High School with Coach Roberts. Now, Coach Roberts was also a baseball coach, and he was a very enthusiastic, even evangelical driver's ed instructor, talking about the importance of driving safely. He was a man of solid build with both waistline and hairline, losing ground to the battle of time. He had an infectious laugh, voice of conviction, and made his subject seem like it ranked just ahead of solving world hunger or getting rid of nuclear weapons. We could feel the shattered glass spraying into our faces when he told us about all the horrible cataclysms that were just waiting down the road for us. Every car you pass on the road, he solemnly intoned, is a potential accident about to happen to you. We wrote that down. Driver's ed instructors are a breed apart in most schools. It takes a peculiar sort to load up four or five unskilled teenagers and ride around on public thoroughfares. It was hard to impress on our cocky minds that we didn't already know everything about driving an automobile. And Coach Roberts resolved that Northmont drivers would be terrified of speed, respectful of the power under the hood, and humbled by our ignorance. We would enter the license examiner's office like pilgrims in search of the Holy Grail. Coach Roberts always seemed to be in control, undaunted by battered parking poles and squealing brakes. And he kept an encouraging and even tone of voice under the most trying circumstances. Now, our study hall was housed in the cafeteria. And it was regular theater in the wintertime for a demolition derby out there, because the icy parking lot was where he would bring young people, and it was a testing ground for novices learning to handle a car on ice. Every now and then, when there was a little bit of snow and ice, they'd take you out there, and coach would throw the car into a skid. And at regular and unannounced moments, we would hear a thud of tire rims hitting a curb as a student failed to come out of the skid. Front end would jerk skyward, and all the heads of those inside would whip toward the ceiling, necks stretched out like rubber chickens. And there in the front seat, his eyeballs wide with astonishment or simply the strain of G-force, was good old Coach Roberts. I saw that. And he was unflappable, almost. One time, we pulled into a dealership, and Coach Roberts said, "Well, just pull over here somewhere. Let's stop." Like, it was a brand new car dealership. He said, just stop anywhere. We'll change drivers." The person who was driving just kept going down in a row. He said, "Just stop anywhere. Just stop anywhere." So he tried to pull in between two brand new cars, unfortunately, and there was a sound something like this. He looked at Coach Roberts, who closed his eyes for a moment, and then he said this, "I'll be back." Door open, he went into the dealership. It was kind of a sad thing. He rarely cracked, but it was rumored that there was one omen you needed to watch out for. Some of the older students would tell us that Coach Roberts would whistle whenever he got nervous. And not just any tunes. When he was really afraid, he whistled hymns. A hymn was a sign of impending failure. So in my first turn behind the wheel, I learned the awesome power of making a choice. Now, I was the last driver that day, charged with driving us back to school, and Coach Roberts asked us to hurry as he was nearly, it was nearly time for the bell, and we needed to get to the next period, but getting close to school, we went down a country road that kind of cut through a field behind the school. And it was one of those roads that back in those days we had that was only really 1 3/4 lanes wide. So you had to really be careful. So deadline, narrow road, pressure of the first try. More than anything else, I didn't want to make a mistake. "Please don't let anything bad happen," I prayed, sent it skyward. "And don't make me meet a car head on." Well, here came one. And somebody had thrown a piece of 2x4 on the road, and as I got closer, it had nails sticking up, looking for my tires. So I had a choice. I could swerve over into the other 3/4 of a lane before the other car coming my way got there, or I could slam on the brakes. What should I do? And so think. I could slam the accelerator, roar around that board. That would impress Coach Roberts. But wait, he might think I'm being unsafe. Always be careful. Yeah, that's it. So I'm kind of going back and forth. But what if I'm too timid? And if I pull up too close, I'll puncture a tire. Stop or go. Go or stop. You see, it's not good to do a lot of thinking. You have to be able to just react. And every second that car was getting closer, coming from the other way, I couldn't make up my mind. I sort of went back and forth, and I started to slow down. Then I sped up, and then slowed down and sped up. I glanced out of the corner of my eye to look at the coach. He was smiling, though it looked kind of plastic, like a funeral director or a defiant prisoner about to go to the gallows. And so I just kept thinking, and back and forth. And in a moment of existential impulse, I changed my mind. I released the brake, and I rammed the accelerator to the floor. The board was almost under us. The car was only a few hundred yards away. The engine roared, transmission changed, sounding like a mechanical hernia. I jerked the wheel violently. I leaned forward to help the car. Everybody was leaning forward. I was clutching the wheel as though leaning would help us get there faster. And I was breathing quickly, shallowly, maybe my last. Everyone else was deathly silent. The car careened toward the ditch on the left side, yanked rightward, and roared back into the lane about 75 yards before the petrified man in the other car would have hit us. He was slowing down by then. I couldn't know for certain, but something inside said, I think that man just went potty in his pants. I deaccelerated. The rush of adrenaline was going through me, but I had done it, and I breathed deeply and became conscious again that there were others in the car with me. I didn't look in the rearview mirror. I mumbled weakly, I wonder who left that board up there. And then the verdict was unmistakable. Coach Roberts began to whistle, and it was a tune I knew from church. Rock of ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy wounded side which flowed be of sin the double cure, save from wrath and make me pure. I had failed. Now, I'm hearing a lot these days, and I have a friend who has had some medical issues that caused her to not be able to drive for a long time. And she's just gotten a car that kind of does everything. And even if you take your hands off the wheel for a short period of time, sensors take over and keep you in the lanes. And I think we're headed more and more toward that future where robots kind of drive the car, computers. Apparently, we're going to have robotic production lines and all sorts of things. Automation has huge implications for us. For those of us who are from the busy hands or happy hands school, we do not think this will bode well for humanity. And in the midst of the downsizing and automating, about the only people who will be employed in the future, I suspect, other than funeral directors, and maybe they will be a handful of computer and robot technicians. And I used to think maybe those of us in human services like ministry and psychology and social work, rehab, but apparently robots are even starting to do some of those things. Well, as people have more time on their hands to get in trouble and be depressed, it could be. And then I saw that in Japan many years ago, they had created robot priests for the Buddhist people to give daily prayers and meditation. Will they develop a robot who preaches better than me? Wouldn't take that much. Works 24 hours a day without resting and never has to be paid. Smiles at all the right times, never goes on vacation, and always says the thing that people want to hear. Robots may learn to do a lot, but at this point, there are some things that they still can't do. And maybe one of the biggest ones is to make a moral decision. Now, they can be programmed to respond to certain choices in a preset way, and there are certain forms of religion that kind of go there, that everything's predetermined anyway. I never had much interest in those. I used to tell students when I taught as an adjunct professor that if you have a faith that goes all the way toward predestination or all the way toward free will, it will be inadequate for life. A robot can never consider the ethical, immoral, human consequences of a course of action. Well, maybe it can take into account what humans have always done, but just as sure as you think you've programmed everything in there, something comes along that doesn't fit. I don't think robots will agonize about the possibility of choosing what is wrong. At least they don't suffer the consequences the way we do. That's just part of our profound freedom as human beings. We best be careful about automating all of life. We face all sorts of decisions. Lots of them are automatic, but some are not so much, and we wrestle with those. Deciding is one of the most important things we ever do in this world. But consider another aspect of making decisions, the consequence of the act of a decision. To decide is to change the future. When we make a choice, the word decide comes from a word that means to cut off. You choose something, and something else falls aside, no longer available. That's what it means. And you set a course for the future. And those of us that have lived a long time know that those choices, one after the other, they roll up into a ball and they have consequence that lives long after the choices you make. And so it's not so much that we make our decisions, but that eventually they also make us. The things we choose, the choices we make, the beliefs we hold on to, determine our future. Decisions are important. They determine, one little one at a time, who we become. And at some point, they weigh so heavily on that, that they have set the directions of our lives. We can still move, we can still change, but we are also continually shaped by the deciding that came before us. And so, as you come upon the things that you must change, decide, choose, they are powerful. But lest you feel too much heaviness from that, I'll leave you with this. Saint Bernard, the 12th century monk, told all the monks at his abbey that however early they might rise up in the morning for prayer in a cold midwinter, or even the dead of night, they would always find God awake with them. God was waiting for them, and it was God who had awakened them to seek his face. Sometimes there is the heaviness of carrying our choices. But D.M. Bailey was a wonderful Scottish theologian and preacher who said it's also important for us to find a God who can now and then carry us. Many of us experience a religion that we have to carry, like a terrible burden. And sometimes there is that remarkable experience that we have somehow come through something that we never should have. And even in spite of our choices, and in spite of the things that seemed to be destined, a wind of grace blew through our life, and we made it through. Those two things are there. Maybe the most powerful reality about support groups is this: you're not alone in your suffering. Someone is with you. And so that's it. A morally serious life, a spiritual life, involves important choices with real consequences, and all these things matter. We can't be flippant and avoid them. We make decisions all along the way, and they have consequences that live on long and long and long. But there is also something in life, Christians call it grace, that says, in the midst of all of that are those surprising moments when we are carried. And then Bailey wrote, the only decision we have is to let God do it. The ancient generations who warned us were right. It's a dangerous business, full of consequence, but surely we can always remember that we are not alone in the serious and fateful decisions. So years later, I sat next to my own child, ready to take up this task of impressing upon her how crucial all of this could be, life and death, serious. And I found my mother coming out of my mouth. Dear me, I said, I would never say these kinds of things. But life is scary and complicated. And so we sit in the cars with our children, full of our fears to protect them from everything, and her desire to be free and live a life of her own. whatever it is that holds us all together in that moment is full of hope and promise that calms us down and sends us back on the road into the teeth of terror and fear. And hopefully we can say, let's try again. And off we go, teaching her how to leave me forever, teaching her how to decide, and hoping against hope that she will both decide what matters most of all, and also now and then feel that wind of presence and help. You've been listening to the Flat Picking Pilgrim's Progress. That's it for today. See you next time.
I'm Gary Furr, and this is the Flat Picking Pilgrim's Progress. Thanks for joining me today. You can find my music at gafurr.com, and you can go to my blog site for lots of other information and writings at garyfurr.me, garyfurr.me. Once again, thank you so much. Join me next time on the Flat Picking Pilgrim's Progress.